This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. Join me and an all-female team of detectives as we travel back in time to revisit the crimes of some of the most notorious murderesses of the 19th and 20th centuries from Britain, Australia, and the USA. Today, we're taking you to a lonely farmhouse in rural Devon. Now, this isn't the pretty English countryside you might imagine with cottages and roses around the door. It's a creepy, lonely spot with knee-deep mud and many mouths to feed. On the 4th of January, 1850, a 15-year-old servant, Mary Ann Parsons, lies in bed in one of the upper rooms of Gorland Farm. She's dead. Her emaciated body is horribly battered and bruised.
I heard Sarah Bird scolding the girl about the pig's meat, after which I heard blows and the girl crying. As she turned, I saw blood running down from her head.
I think Molly's dead. She's so quiet.
I saw that the legs had been lashed with a small birch, more especially below the knees. The flesh on both of the legs was torn. There were 40 or 50 cuts on the calves and front part of the legs, and the marks were as if produced by a pin or knitting needle.
Of all the things I ever heard of or saw in my life, I never saw anything like this corpse.
In Lady Killers, we re-examine the lives and crimes of murderesses of the past, these ordinary women who did extraordinary things. We hear their words, their voices. We visit the scene of the crime and we delve deep into their lives to ask, how did they do it? Why did they do it? And perhaps most importantly, what drove them to it? We're seeking to understand these women, to understand their circumstances from the perspective of modern day feminists. Today's alleged killer is Sarah Bird, the wife of a farmer, mother of four children, who's accused of abuse, depravity, and the murder of this poor young employee. With me in the studio to discuss this case is our guest detective, Baroness Helena Kennedy, a woman of extraordinary achievement, a barrister, a specialist in the law about human rights, and she's an expert on modern slavery and human trafficking. Helena, thank you for joining us.
Very nice to be here, Lucy.
Now, to start off our investigation, I met our resident Lady Killers historian, Rosalind Crone, Professor of History at the Open University in beautiful Devon.
This is Buckland Brewer. It's an idyllic village. The birds are singing, there are primroses, there are all sorts of lovely little cottages, there's a community shop. But in 1849, when a new family came rattling down the street in their wagon to move into the neighbourhood, I think it wasn't such a rural idyll. Ros, what was the area like then?
Okay, well, I mean, we've got traces of what it was like still in the landscape here today, the church behind us, some of the cottages, the pub down there. But if you can imagine, it would have been a lot more muddy and difficult travelling through. And it was a difficult time, the late 1840s as well, just coming out of the hungry 40s. Devon at this time, contemporaries thought it was quite backward in terms of the farming and the agriculture that was going on here. People talked about the homes here being crumbling cob, you know, with thatched roofs.
It still feels pretty remote. And this family of newcomers were Mr. and Mrs. Bird, three children, and the baby. They were from Devon, but this was a whole new world for them. Do you imagine there was curtain twitching as they came down the street?
Yeah, no, I think it's important to remember that they are strangers to the area.
What had brought them here?
They came here because Robert had a connection to the parish. It looks like Robert and the family had been called back to take on the family farm.
So it's an opportunity to begin a new life. This could be a fresh start. It's a big moment of change. It's the start of the story.
The family set up their new home at Gorland Farm. There is so much work to do. Pigs and cows to look after and a family to feed. Sarah is not yet 35. She's got three children under her feet and a babe in arms. The first thing she does is try to get some help. She travels 8 miles, likely by foot, to the Biddeford Union Workhouse. There she can get a servant that she won't have to pay. We're fascinated, aren't we, by the upstairs-downstairs world of the Victorians. But the truth is that millions of people across the globe today are still employed in domestic work. And sadly, many of them are trapped in domestic servitude too. Helena, turning to you, domestic servitude is one of the most prevalent forms of modern slavery in the UK. Can you tell us a little bit about your work in this area?
Over the years, I've done a number of different cases that have touched into this area before it was described as being modern slavery. I mean, it was really about exploitation. I remember cases coming into chambers where usually it was in ambassadorial households and they would bring their people who'd worked for them in the places they came from. And often people whose passports were taken from them, who entered under this sort of special ambassadorial arrangements that there are for those who come to work in those diplomacy positions. But the women often were there to look after the small children, to run the kitchen, to do all the domestic work and unburden the woman who was the head of the household. And so we came aware, and cases came to chambers where a woman had fled from the household because she was being abused, exploited, and suddenly could take no more, but did not have her papers, her documentation, in order to go on to other work or anything. And very often those women were terrified. And when you heard the descriptions of what happened to them domestically, it was pretty hard listening to. As well as individual cases which came into chambers, I had the opportunity when the Modern Slavery Act came in of going to Scotland and chairing an inquiry into why it was that in Scotland there hadn't been any prosecutions under the Modern Slavery Act. And so I, for a period of time, took evidence about that. And it was then that I became aware that even domestic servitude was a problem in Scotland and throughout the United Kingdom, and that it was that people would work in households and basically would have surrendered their passports. It was usually people who'd come from abroad and who were basically treated as if they were slaves. I mean, they would not have payment into their hands. They would not be able to change their employer. And they really felt that they were imprisoned in a household.
Lots of echoes there for what happened back in our story in 1849. Now, when Sarah Bird arrives at the workhouse, I suspect she's quite cheerful at the prospect of finding a sensible girl to help her for free. The parish apprentice system they have in Devon means that youngsters from the workhouse don't get paid, but they do get board and lodging in exchange for their work.
I am the master of the Biddeford Union. Mrs. Berg came and made application for a girl to work. She selected Mary Ann Parsons. She took her away on the 29th of September. She was in perfect health, strong and healthy, although not particularly bright.
The actual workhouse where Sarah Bird selected her girl to work still stands in Biddeford today. Ros and I went to see it and to find out more about the unfortunate Mary Ann.
We are standing under this formidable, great big gateway that really says, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. And over there, there's a big, tall, impressive, fortress-like looking main block. Today, Ros, the word workhouse, it fills your heart with doom, doesn't it? Was that fair? What were Victorian workhouses really like?
Now, the conditions inside the workhouse were meant to be worse than what they would be outside. So you were given, were meant to be given, a subsistence diet, so just enough food to keep you alive. Families were split up, men into male wards, women into female wards, and children into separate wards as well. And if you were able-bodied, you were meant to work for your keep, if you like, when you were inside the workhouse.
Do we know what Mary Ann did in here?
We know that she was in here for about 3 or 4 years. We don't know what she was doing inside the workhouse, but we do know that they had a kind of marked out as someone who could be sent out to be a parish apprentice.
So Sarah Bird comes here, checks out the inmate, says, I'll have that one there, Mary Ann. She looks like a good, strong girl. Was this considered to be a good thing for Mary Ann? She'd be parted from her mum at this moment.
That's right, because her mother was in the workhouse with as well. I think it was certainly a good thing for the parish, because sending these children out as parish apprentices meant that they didn't have to pay for them anymore. But for Mary Ann, it could have been good, depending on the family she was put with, who might have taken their duties as her new guardian seriously and given her a bit more of a family life, or it could have gone disastrously wrong.
Back in the studio with Baroness Helena Kennedy. So Mary Ann knew that she wouldn't be paid, yet she might have thought this was a good opportunity to escape the workhouse. What do you think? Do you think people entering into these kind of exploitative conditions sometimes are led to think they're going to get a better life?
Oh, yes. You've got to remember that the workhouse was a place that families ended up in when they become destitute. And so I imagine that life was pretty wretched in the workhouse. So being told that here's an opportunity to go and help a family and that you'll be part of this family would be presented in a way that I think would sound rather attractive.
Sarah Bird now takes Mary Ann Parsons home with her to Gorland Farm. Mary Ann settles in well.
Mrs. Bird came to the union and applied for a pair of shoes for her. I asked how the child went on. She said she was one of the best children she had ever had in the house, that she knew how to tell the truth and was the honestest child she'd ever had.
But by December, the relationship between Sarah and Mary Ann is turning sour. Sarah tells the workhouse master that Mary Ann has started to steal and tell falsehoods and to be idle. And he, Thomas Sermon is his name, responds by saying, well, in that case, you ought to chastise her. Sarah takes this advice literally. When a local shoemaker called James Morrish visits the farm, he sees the girl in distress.
She appeared to have been crying. I saw that her neck and shoulders were covered with blood, which appeared to have flown just before I came in.
And the local stonemason, William Toppas, also hears Sarah Bird chastising away.
I was near the door. I heard Sarah Bird scolding the girl about the pig's meat, after which I heard blows and the girl crying. The door was shut, but I heard more blows and the girl crying. Soon after, she came out with the pig's meat. Her face was bloody. Afterwards, she showed me some marks on her left arm, above the elbow as if hurt with a stick.
Helena, it sounds from these witnesses like she was enduring abuse, beatings, physical blows to her body. Is that how you'd interpret it if they came into court?
Oh, yes. We've got to remember that a lot of abuse happens behind closed doors inside domestic environments. And that's true today as it was then, although there was a much greater willingness to chastise, to use physical punishment. The evidence of these witnesses is very clear that there's serious abuse going on towards Mary Ann.
It really hurts me in my heart, though, that it was Sarah, a woman, a mother. But this is something that happens.
I'm afraid so. More recently, I've been involved in investigations into cases against Yazidi women in northern Iraq, where what would be described, I think, as a genocide was committed against the Yazidi people, an ancient people who live in northern Iraq on the borders with Syria, and ISIL, Daesh, the Islamic State operatives who were in that area, slaughtered many of the menfolk, enslaved the women and turned them into sexual slaves. And unfortunately, when I was there taking evidence a few years ago, the women also described how the wives of the ISIL fighters had beaten and battered them because they resented that their menfolk were taking a sexual interest in other women. The idea that there was a sexual slave in the household who was there at the beck and call of a husband was a source of great resentment, and the women were very cruel to those Yazidi slaves.
Can we speculate that's what's happening here?
What I postulate is that was there also a deeper resentment here? Is it possible that Marianne had drawn the attention even of Sarah's husband in ways that Sarah resented? Was it that Sarah resented the youthfulness of this girl when she herself is now a woman who's downtrodden with a whole set of kids and the work of the farm? And so the proximity in those relationships, all living in tight conditions, that sort of circumstance does lead to violence.
Well, I'm itching to see the place where the grim story unfolded and imagine the life Marianne led. Sadly, Gorland Farm itself now lies in ruins, but a neighbouring farm still stands. So Rosalind Crone and I went to take a look.
We're standing in the farmyard in the rain. It's a bit cold and wet, and you just get a bit of a glimpse of how grim life in the countryside can be in miserable weather. Let's go and explore this farm a little bit. I can hear cows mooing. I'm now imagining poor Marianne feeding the pigs, clanking her pail, and then quietly sneaking off to hide in the barn, somewhere like this, to escape from these really terrible beatings.
Yes, and we know that the abuse actually got worse over time. And I brought something that's quite horrifying to show you, Lucy. This is a whip. It's actually a livestock whip. Now, witnesses allege that a whip just like this, with 18 leathern thongs attached and a pole of about a foot long, they allege that a whip just like this was used on Marianne. Isn't it just horrific to think? And the witnesses at the time, they were pretty horrified by this as well. They said it was such a rod of correction as an individual with the slightest humanity would not make use of.
This is brutal stuff.
It is brutal stuff.
Poor Marianne's life comes to a tragic end on the 4th of January 1850, when the birds find her dead in her bed. They inform the workhouse, and the master sets off for the farm to find out what's happened, with Marianne's mother following along too. That poor woman. They were horrified to find Marianne's body not only dead, but scarred with dreadful injuries. Sarah Bird now pleads with Marianne's mother not to call an inquest. But even so, an inquest is opened, which finds out that Marianne had died from a blow to the head, with no indication of any wrongdoing. Although some local people had witnessed the abuse, but kept quiet while Marianne was alive, there is now a sense of outrage beginning to ripple through the parish. In response to the outcry, the birds are arrested and they are examined by the magistrate. They are charged with murder and committed for trial. On the day of the trial, the court is crowded to suffocation. The case has now sparked a frenzy of interest and more gory details are revealed. Thomas Sermon, the workhouse master, tells the court,
"I went to Gorland Farm. I saw that the legs had been lashed with a small birch or something of that kind, more especially below the knees. The flesh on both of the legs was torn. Now, I've been in the army and frequently seen sentences of whipping executed under orders of court-martial. We used to say it was not fair thrashing if the flesh was cut with the end of the instrument, in a similar manner to the legs of the deceased."
That whip had been found hidden in a drawer at the farm, and now it's produced in court. There are gasps of horror. A surgeon testifies to the shocking state of the girl's body.
"I immediately discovered several marks of violence. There was a large slough on the right hip and four small wounds, apparently of old date, varying in size from half a crown to a shilling. There were abscesses on the upper and forepart of the left arm. The nails on the fingers of the left hand were gone. The bone on the second finger was protruding. From the appearance of the body of Marianne Parsons, my opinion is she died a violent death."
So he's clear that the external injuries weren't from falling over, as that inquest has suggested. Even more damningly, Mary-Ann's mother, Grace, testifies that Sarah Bird had asked for forgiveness and had confessed that she was in fault and that she had flogged the child. But, and here's a twist to the tale, the jury declare that Robert and Sarah Bird are not guilty. They say that although Mary-Ann died from a blow to the head, it cannot be proven if it was Sarah or Robert Bird who dealt it, or in fact whether it was from a fall and not from a human hand after all. The Birds are released scot-free. I'm with our guest detective, Baroness Helena Kennedy. Now, would this happen today? People found not guilty because it can't be determined which one was more at fault.
Now, today we would be saying you can draw inferences that this child, this young person, died as a result of violence and inflicted clearly by others and inflicted by those who were regularly doing it to her, and particularly Sarah. And so I think a jury today is horrified by violence towards someone living in a household, someone who's still a child. So that let me just say that. It's about the normalisation of violence, and happily society has moved on and is less accepting of that. The second issue is the one where two persons are in the dock and a killing has taken place of a child, and we don't know because there is no direct evidence as to who was responsible for the killing blows. But now, if Sarah is the person who is inflicting the cruelty on this maidservant, the fact that her husband allows it to happen, nowadays you would be convicted of cruelty to a child or of being a party to either the manslaughter or murder, depending on the circumstances. So we're much clearer that we can't let people walk away simply because they didn't inflict the blow. If you have remained silent and allowed things to happen and been complicit in it, then courts are much more prepared to convict in those sort of circumstances today.
Despite that not guilty verdict, it isn't all over yet for Sarah and Robert Bird, because the case now catches the attention of the national papers and of intellectuals like John Stuart Mill and his partner Harriet Taylor. These two have begun a crusade against injustice and cruelty, and they declare this case one of the most horrible cases of brutality which have ever disgraced the superficial civilization of our time and country. They helped to get this case into the national spotlight, and there's public outcry that the two birds had walked free. To understand the twists and turns of what happens next, I've asked our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, to join us.
Hello, Ros.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Lovely to meet you. Hello, Lucy.
Can you tell us what happens next?
Well, you've already mentioned that there was a national scandal around this case. So the couple, Sarah and Robert Bird, were arrested again in April 1850. And in August that year, they were tried for assault and convicted. However, sentence could not be passed because there was a bit of a concern about the double jeopardy rule, that they couldn't be tried for the same offence twice. So they were sent to jail to wait while a point of law was argued in courts down in London. At that time, there was another case that hit the headlines. A servant, Jane Wilbred, had been abused by her employers in London, George and Therese Sloan. And the papers linked those two cases together. They discussed them at the same time. So that national outrage just continued.
I guess from our perspective, it's kind of lazy, but commonly said, oh, those Victorians, they're obsessed with physical chastisement and beatings and punishings. But is this case a moment when things begin to change about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think they were obsessed with chastisement and violence, but not in the way that's often presented in popular culture. So the first thing that's important to say is that there was a kind of acceptance of certain forms of violence in society, especially around chastisement. Men could beat their wives, employers could beat their servants and their apprentices, and parents, of course, could beat their children. However, the violence inflicted as chastisement had to be reasonable. Now, there's a problem there always. What is reasonable? It's often easier to tell what is reasonable retrospectively when something goes wrong. There was also at this time a growing intolerance to violence, including physical chastisement, but also more extreme forms of violence. And that was a concern, not just about violence, but unregulated passion. And that's what you see here. It's violence that goes too far because people lose control of themselves.
What actually happens to Robert and Sarah Bird?
in March 1851, so 8 months after their conviction for assault, they're finally given a sentence of 16 months imprisonment.
I'm so surprised because of the double jeopardy rule not kicking in with more vehemence at the time. Double jeopardy, of course, meant that you can't try people over and over again until you get your conviction. And that was changed after the Stephen Lawrence case, where some of the young men who it was alleged had been involved in his stabbing and the killing, the case against them was not successful in the first trial, and some were acquitted at halftime, and the double jeopardy rule was changed in law. And many had great anxieties about that because it could mean that the state would keep going after people. But instead, the rules were very clear that it could only be done if an application was made to the Court of Appeal and there was new evidence and it would be in exceptional cases. So I suppose what they were saying was that the thing that killed this young maidservant was a blow to the head, and they were acquitted of that. But the fact that she was constantly at the receiving end of abuse and beatings over a period of time, that they therefore were able to prosecute separately for that.
Was anybody really guilty here?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that one or other of this household, the husband or wife, were responsible for the killing of the girl. I wouldn't want to say definitely that it was Sarah, because this blow seemed to be out of kilter with her normal conduct, which was usually to whip and lash and to inflict harm with the birch. And so I feel that this heavy blow to the head seems rather different. And so I wouldn't be too ready to say that it was necessarily Sarah. I think that her good husband might well have had a hand in this.
It seems to me that the abuse committed at Gorland Farm isn't something that we can safely consign into the past. In this remote spot, a toxic culture of abuse became the norm, and people turned a blind eye to what was going on behind closed doors. Today, human rights abuses still occur all around us, and there are people in Britain right now being controlled and exploited. I'm very grateful for the work of Baroness Helena Kennedy, not only reminding us that slavery still exists today, but more generally for her work speaking for the powerless. Now, some things have changed. Violence like this, inflicted on a minor, would horrify a jury today, and Sarah Bird would most likely be found guilty of both cruelty and complicity in Marianne's death. As ever, though, I'm struck by the way we're more similar to the Victorians than we might think. Their horror about this case is something that we'd recognise and identify with today. Enormous thank yous to Professor Rosalind Crone, to Janet Few from the Buckland Brewer History Society, and of course to our guest detective Baroness Helena Kennedy. Join me next time on Lady Killers in Memphis, Tennessee, where an illicit love affair between two teenage girls goes wrong with devastating consequences. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Emily Hughes, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Hable. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. If you want to know even more about how we bring these fascinating stories to life for this podcast, you can join Roz and I for an exclusive behind-the-scenes chat about what it takes to make Lady Killers. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University.
Hello, I'm India Axon, and I just want to quickly talk to you about witches. In this series from BBC Radio 4, simply titled Witch, I'm going to explore the meaning of the word today. It is a twisting, turning rabbit warren of a world, full of forgotten connections to land and to power, lost graves, stolen words, and indelible marks on the world. Because the story of the witch is actually the story of us all. Come and find out why on Witch with me, India Rackerson. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachim.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.